Finn Coleman.
But let me say, and as you know, Lynn, with respect to the fraud center, we were, as a result of the discussion that happened in the Treasury report, you may recall there was a lot of discussion about where it should be housed, and when the recommendation came out that it should be housed with the PCAOB, I made the point, and I think others did, that we were not looking for new opportunities or new jurisdiction, but we did not oppose that. So I think implicit in that is that we're taking that into consideration.
Thank you, Mark. Finn Coleman.
Yeah, I guess, and everybody's been teasing about agreeing with you, Lynn. I was just pleased with what you just talked about around the standard-setting process. I mean, it is a different process, and I would also encourage the board to really think about the process. There are, whether it be the auditing standards board process, or quite frankly, there's other processes in the standard setting that has more transparency in it than this one. And I think what happened during the quality review standard is an excellent example of how that process can be improved. And then secondly, I just have an overarching question that I've still not been able to, when it comes to the standard setting, fully understand. And I just, as a SAG member or an interested party, would really like to understand at some point in time, and I think you referenced it a little bit, Jennifer, but the guiding principles. What are the guiding principles that set the priorities? Okay, is one of those guiding principles, of how you're going to set the priorities, or is it, say, reactionary or judgments? Some of which was Joe's talking about is a priority with respect to what you learn, it's just not understandable to me. I've never really been able to figure it out. Is a priority convergence? In other words, is that an overarching principle or not? Because I think it should be. And to the extent there's differences, well, then fine, there's differences. We explain why they are. You support why there's a difference, and we all move forward. And then lastly, is an overarching principle cost-benefit? You know, to ensure that when we're putting something in place, we understand the ramifications of it. And I just think if we had some type of framework, it'd be really helpful because here we're just setting events that are happening here, and I'd like to understand what drives those events.
I feel like that deserves some type of reaction, although we have not published any driving principles, although in our standard setting projects we've made reference to a variety of different factors, such as, Sarbanes-Oxley Act mandating certain things or observations from inspections. A significant input for us has been input and advice from the Standing Advisory Group. And as Greg mentioned when he talked about our list of projects, that, many of them were on the list last year and have carried forward as important topics that came from discussions with the SAG. So they remain in our list, and I outlined our timing with respect to moving forward and issuing either a concept release or proposed standards or finalizing those projects. So there's while we haven't published any guiding principles, there's a lot of factors such as what's going on in the environment, legislative activities. There may be significant developments by other standard setters that we think warrant attention and move forward. Certainly the Treasury Advisory Committee is one factor that influences our standing setting activities. So there's a lot of various principles. And you talked about convergence and in risk assessment. We discussed looking at other standard setters and differences, some of the differences are the reasons we made differences and looking for public comment on that. So. Your comments are good ones, and just wanted to provide you with some initial observations. Kurt Schott.
Thank you, Jennifer. Just a quick question. Have you discussed, and would it be appropriate, given the rather new and important component to financial condition that a number of firms are going to be facing, to coordinate with FASB and the SEC for some specific discussion in the financial reports and audit attention to the level of and the reliance upon the government credit assistance program?
I'm looking to you, Mark, and you're looking to me. Do you
And let's give that some thought. I think is the right answer to that. I don't know that we have an answer right off the top of our head.
That's a good comment.
Kurt, was there anything in particular you were focused on with respect to that program, and anything you were thinking about initially?
Well, I think first and foremost, the obvious question is, what does it do to the going concern analysis?
That was what I was thinking about initially, was the going concern, but I didn't know if there's, you know, anything else beyond that. Okay.
Dick Dietrich.
Thank you. Last weekend, I was reading the Advisory Committee on the Auditing Professions report, and I learned that there's an elephant in the room. So I don't know if you all had a chance to read that letter, but here's the way I interpret this. Separation of duties is an important thing, and one of the most important structural changes we made in corporate governance is to impose independent audit committees that would have the responsibility of overseeing the relationship between the auditor and the company on behalf of the shareholders. During our breakout session yesterday, I think there were questions raised about the extent to which the audit committee had common cause with the investors generally, and that one could not presuppose that that was always working well. And if we ask the question, who oversees the work of the audit committee? We certainly have the PCAOB to oversee the work of the auditors. We have the auditors to oversee the work of management with respect to financial reporting. But who oversees that other entity, the audit committee? While this may appear to be outside the purview of the PCAOB, it strikes me as a very important question on maintaining the integrity of the financial reporting process. I don't know if that's the elephant in the room or not, but it's the one that I have heard increasingly frequently mentioned by people in public accounting. And the story often goes something like this. The audit committee defers to management to work directly with the auditor to determine the scope of the audit, where audits will be conducted, the number of hours that will be incorporated into the audit. And once they have resolved that, they take it to the audit committee, and the audit committee reviews the work and then makes a determination. The thing that concerns me about that process is that we have a breakdown, I fear, in the separation of duties that was contemplated in constructing independent audit committees. There are potentially remedies that the PCAOB could undertake to address this that might help to reinvigorate the separation of duties that I think was contemplated in Sarbanes-Oxley, and I would suggest that the board give consideration to doing so. Thank you.
Just as a follow-up, do you have any particular remedies in mind that we could undertake?
Oh, I have the remedies of an academic, which may or may not be at all practical. But one remedy, for example, would be if we take independence seriously, then it would seem to me that management should have no conversations with an auditor having to do with the scope of the audit. But that should be a decision that's made by the audit committee and not by management. Now, I don't mean to malign the integrity of management, who may be working in the best interest of shareholders too, but we have to contemplate in the structure that we can't presume that that will happen. So one of the things that potentially one could say is there should not be conversations like that between management and the auditor directly on the scope of the audit or other activities related to the work of the auditor. Certainly there has to be lots of conversations going back and forth about specific matters during the conduct of the audit. But what one could say is, if there were conversations, and let me just pose one, if I were a nefarious CFO and I didn't want my auditor to be really doing things that would actually cause him to find the places in the financial statements where I have misstated material numbers. So I could say, look, there's no reason for you to make a trip to the division that happens to be in a foreign country. It's very expensive for you to do that. We want to keep down audit fees, and I know that that's where the problems are, so I don't want you down there. Now, I'm not going to say that last part of the phrase, but that's what's in my head. And so the question is, should we allow those kinds of conversations to take place? Well, all you'd have to say is it would be a violation of auditor independence if those conversations took place. The way to cure the violation by the auditor would be to raise his hand and send immediately a letter to the audit committee and potentially file an 8K. Again, these are the thoughts of an academic. But you could say something like, at least inform the audit committee. Beyond that, there's not a strong enough structure. I mean, we're left to the investor community to try to monitor the activities of the audit committee. That's the weakest link that I think we have right now in the current structure. And it may be related, and I apologize, I'm not sure, but it may be related to this elephant in the room, to the extent that it's still management who's determining how much to pay the auditor. Or one of the other examples I heard was an audit partner who told me that they had expended 13,000 hours on an audit last year, and the CFO said, get it down to 12,000 or we're going to recommend that we go out for bids. That strikes me as back in the situation where the audit committee was not really running things again. Now, it's possible that the audit committee chair could have said, no, we want to still scope the audit at 13,000 hours. But it's also possible that the audit committee chair would say, oh, I'm listening to you very carefully, dear CFO, and so turn to the audit partner and say, so what's wrong with 12,000 hours? That would put the partner, I think, in a very difficult position. And that's maybe something that the board could consider, how those kinds of communications might work appropriately and what might be inappropriate, and determine whether or not they could construct a mechanism that would preclude those kinds of inappropriate, or what I perceive to be inappropriate communications that serve only to degrade the quality of the audit.
Thank you. I'd be interested, kind of like I did in the last round, if there's kind of views or observations in connection with that comment. And I see we've got two going up right now. So because I asked for any immediate response, looks like I'll take the line down there. Vin Coleman was, I think, first.
I like how you talk about the academic. I would just make one point. Do I think that there could be improvement in perhaps the communication, education of audit committees and doing their roles? Sure. But the notion to say that there should be no communication with management and during your scoping and risk assessment, I would tell you that process, if it's done right by all of the stakeholders, actually can be valuable if the audit committee is doing what they're doing. So the notion to say we'll do it without the without management's assistance, that there can be very healthy tension in those discussions about having an effective and an efficient, you know, risk assessment and audit plan, as long as your point's well taken, that there's the appropriate oversight of that as part of the process. But I wouldn't want to say it's inappropriate to have a conversation with management.
Yeah, and
I think that's a little...
No, I'm
not sure I would recommend that.
I didn't
that.
State that carefully enough, Vin. I think a conversation like that in the presence of the audit committee is fine. It's a question of whether those conversations can occur outside of the presence of the audit committee. Certainly in the presence of the audit committee, not a problem from my perspective.
Well, you don't want to solve this, but there's a great example to the extent that there was that notion that then, by definition, you have a disagreement with management. You should be having that communication with the audit committee under today's standards. So there's a mechanism today for that.
Galen Hansen.
Yeah, I was talking to Dick about this at one of the prior breaks, and I do agree with some of those perceptions, although I do also agree with Vince's observation. I think management is an important part of the inputs into the developing of the scope, but they shouldn't be part of the outputs, and it may be worth some sort of, you know, what is inappropriate communications. with management, whenever you get into scope limitations, I mean, maybe it's not a problem with the Fortune 500, but at my level and the firms that I'm working with, you know, a lot of times the focus of these audit committees, and particularly the CFOs, the CEOs, some of them have spent a good deal of time with audit firms before they became the controller or the CFO, and one thing that they do know how to control is audit fees. They may not understand the operations of the company yet, but in a new role especially, that's where a lot of the focus is how to control the audit fee. And I think that it is something that really has no place, and I think most of us would agree with that.
Joe Carcello.
Well, Dick and I have talked about this this issue before, so I don't know if the specifics of what he recommends are the best way forward, and he was very modest in how he presented it, but I do think he's identified a real problem. And one of the things that concerned me about Sarbanes when it was written is there's tremendous amount of oversight of auditors, a huge amount, and much more oversight and liability for senior management. But so much of the law really hinges on the audit committee doing their job well. And I think some of them do, and probably more than we would like don't. And so although that's not directly your mandate, there's probably an indirect effect through your standards on auditors, so I think you should probably be thinking about that. The other issue I would raise is just, I think, in general, again, I don't know if it's Tom's group or George's group or other groups within the board, is to be looking at what I'll call indirect effects of other behavior in the markets. Without going into too much in the way of specifics, there's some evidence to suggest that portion of non-accelerated filers are not including the 404A report, even though they're required to. And if the SEC ever expands the 404B certification to those filers, and if they do it in a timely manner, I think, you know, a second order effect would be how could you possibly have effective internal control over financial reporting if you didn't even include the report in the first place, even if you filed it late? The fact that you didn't know or you ignored the responsibility to do it would seem to me to be de facto proof that you don't have effective internal control over financial reporting. And I would look at the auditor opinions on those. And if you get auditor opinions, if 404B is extended, that say there is effective internal control over financial reporting, that would really trouble me a lot about what the auditors are doing. So it's those examples of second and third order effects that I think as regulators are good things to be thinking about and looking for.
Thank you, Joe. Chuck Noski, did you have a comment in response to Dick Dietrich?
I did, thank you. Dick, I'm sure you're concerned that when the audit committee abdicates their responsibility to management, that you have a problem. And I'm not sure I've got a good answer for you, and I don't know that you want to set up a PCAOB for audit committees. I don't know who would want to be on that board. I do think, though, that we've had some experience now for a few years on the definition of an audit committee financial expert. And if you recall, in the design of that, it started out as a relatively narrow definition with lots of functional and professional experience, and then it got broadened out to anybody who ever supervised a chief financial officer, and then some. So it may be time to revisit that definition as a way of strengthening the audit committee and at least helping them have a better understanding of what it is they're supposed to be doing. I agree with the earlier comments. I would be reluctant to keep management out of the audit scope and audit risk discussions, but again, it's got to be a balanced dialogue among management, the audit committee, and the auditor, with a heavy dose, at least in my experience, of executive sessions between the audit committee and the auditor about audit risk and audit scope. Rather than prescribing the communications between management and the auditor, and I think Mark Olson heard me say this over 2 years ago, I think that communications between auditors and audit committees as provided for in the auditing standards is poor and not particularly helpful to the charter of the audit committee or the obligations that we have on those committees. So I would encourage, as you think about priorities, Jennifer, I would encourage you to look at the communications between audit committees and auditors. I think the written communications are poor at best. I think many auditors are confused, sometimes by management, sometimes by their inexperience, as to what their obligations are with respect to the audit committee. And I encourage my auditors on the audit committees I serve on to read the audit committee charter and ask themselves what they're doing to help the audit committee completely and achieve all of the objectives in that audit committee charter in a very professional way. Thanks.
Thank you, Chuck. Now I think I'm back on track, and I thank you for the additional feedback or reaction in connection with Dick Dietrich's comment. That was helpful. So next is Bob Tarola.
Thanks, Jennifer. I put my tent card up for another reason, but I want to weigh in and echo what Chuck just said about more robust, more relevant communications with audit committees. It is too boilerplate, in my opinion. But the reason I put my tent card up was because I think there's an issue that I feel as an issuer. Investors are asking for more information of us, either directly or through the channels of the SEC or other bodies. More information, more often, more granular, often not financial in nature, key performance indicators and the like, and definitely in the near term in electronic format. So that issuer information is being disseminated in the marketplace through means other than the typical paper full financial statement. And auditor association involvement, assurance on that information, I think would be an important factor in the marketplace. I know the AICPA is looking at that to some degree, but I think the PCAOB also ought to have it on its agenda to examine, perhaps not as a number one priority, but at least on the list.
I'd like to ask you a follow-up question. You talked about just the current communications are poor, too boilerplate, or I think you might have said that. Just anything in particular or anything else you might, you know, be looking for that would be helpful from the issue, you know, from that perspective?
As an audit committee member?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Chuck had it right on. If the auditing firm focused on helping the committee fulfill its charter obligations, I also think that's an obligation of management, frankly. But moreover, qualitative commentary about factors affecting the audit, factors affecting the company, factors affecting all the things that go into determining whether or not financial statements are fairly presented and future risk is understood.
Thank you. So John Kellis.
Thank you. If I can remember what I was going to say, because it seems so long ago that I put the card up. But first of all, a lot of what is in these slides looks familiar, and to that extent, it is always good that standard setters seem to have very similar priorities, and I think in the meetings of national standard setters which you and I attend, it's clear that there are common issues and common themes, and therefore it's no surprise as to which issues are here. We have, as you know, recently or will soon have completed the revision of all our standards, and with that in mind we had a consultation on what we should be doing after that, and there was generally a common consensus that we probably have done enough on the straightforward standard side, with the possible exception, well, one of the standards that was raised was whether internal audit practice had perhaps gone ahead of current auditing standards, and maybe that should be looked at again, and we are going to do that. You mentioned the audit report. That came through as a theme that we ought to be looking at. The audit report excites comments from investors and others, including people within the profession, as to whether it is in reality the best advertisement for the work that auditors do. And so we have it in mind to look at that. We are not looking at introducing any new standards within the next 2 years, but that will give us an opportunity to do some research into audit reports, for example, and to see what people want out of them, and whether what people want out of them is something that auditors can deliver. We're also going to use this time to look at issues of audit quality that have been discussed here, and following on from the UK work. We think there is work to be done there, and you could imagine that that might lead to something that is directed as much at audit committees as at auditors themselves. We are quite keen to develop a process, and here you have the advantage on us, of seeing how effective standards have been maybe 2 years after their issue in achieving the objectives that we had for them. And here I think the inspection process is enormously helpful. And I think on an international basis there's a challenge in trying to get the results of inspections throughout the world. But I think we need to find a means of doing that. So we will be certainly looking at that over the next couple of years. Also, cost-benefit, as Vin Coleman raised, the whole question of impact assessments is something that we need to resolve. Again, with legislators adopting standards in certain jurisdiction, cost-benefit considerations and impact assessments become that bit more important. So I think we've got quite a lot that will be going on that is a sort of parallel with standard development, but aimed at improving the quality of audits over the next 2 years or so. But I think that as this is my last meeting, I might just raise the question of convergence, and again, Vin Coleman has referred to this. I haven't had a chance to look at your new suite of 7 exposure drafts, but I'm certainly very pleased that you have a comparison or some information about differences with international standards. And I think I believe very strongly that convergence is important, and I think it is important for audit quality. The stability of the US markets is not solely dependent on the audit work conducted within the boundaries of the United States, but also, of course, the audit work conducted outside, first of all on subsidiaries of US enterprises, but also on the financial statements of foreign registrants. And it seems to me self-evident that if you had an auditor in another jurisdiction seeking to meet your standards, then for that auditor to know precisely what is the difference between your standards and the standards that that auditor would normally apply is going to be helpful to the extent that people accept that standards are necessary for audit quality. And therefore, I think you have the review of interim standards, for example, on your program, and I think I would like to think that perhaps in conjunction with ourselves and other national standard setters, that you do put a significant premium on achieving convergence, because I do believe that it will, in the long run, benefit the users of financial statements, who are, after all, the beneficiaries of auditing standards.
Okay. Well, John, certainly in our risk assessment proposal, there is an appendix which outlines the notable differences with the ISAs. And Certainly one in our jurisdiction is the audit of internal control over financial reporting, which, you know, obviously has a is a significant audit effort as well, which internationally that does not exist. So that certainly kind of is a common theme as far as notable differences with the standards. But, you know, we are certainly in public comment and, you know, feedback on what we've done in the risk assessment standards. And, you know, thank you for your comments. And then, let's see, Lynn Turner.
Just a couple points. I too, would like to echo what Chuck had said earlier about the audit committees and the communication. For those who around the table, there were a number of them that worked on the old Blue Ribbon panel report on audit committees, and it was built on the notion of a three-legged stool, which had really as people working together, the auditor and the audit committee and the management team, the CFO. And I do think you got to have all three working together, and you can't be excluding one totally to the exclusion of the other, or you just have a breakdown in the process. And Chuck mentioned, and so did Bob, the audit communication and the real need to improve that. And I think very much so along the lines of what Chuck said, picking up the audit committee charter and saying, how can you help me do this, is excellent. But as I recall, the last 2 years, in the same meeting up on the slide, we've had auditor communication as one of the projects that was going to be worked on. And certainly the Auditing Standards Board has been doing that, and I think has recently put something out on that, and yet we still haven't seen anything forthcoming out of this group. And now this year I don't see it up on the list. And so is that been dropped from the list of priorities? Is that gone now, or is it still a work in process? And if we dropped it, why did it get dropped and not get done? Because I think that is an important project, especially in light of what the ASB does. And it seems like the ASB constantly is ahead of this group, and this group is constantly behind the curve with respect to the work that the ASB is doing. And I constantly hear people say, will you guys ever be able to catch up to them and get ahead of the curve rather than be behind the profession all the time, which is a valid concern. And so I think on this one, the question comes, what happened with the auditor communication project, and is it just gone defunct now?
In response to your question on that, Lynn, we've had some draft. We have a draft standard and some recommendations to the board, and we've had some other projects to get in front of it. But if you think it's, and if other members of the SAG think it's that important, then we can certainly reconsider and move that back up to where, you know, back on the schedule.
It just seems, you know, again, year and year and year, we see these same slides, and I think I make the same comment about the last 3 years now. We see projects go on, you spend time on the projects, and then they disappear. If you spend all the time and all the money and budget on a project to get to a draft stage, and now all of a sudden it's just put on the backside, it raises the question of, are we really being effective as an organization in getting things out and really prioritized and focused? And I do think this is an important thing. Would I make it top? Probably not. I still think the fraud stuff ought to be front and center, along with the auditor's report. But, yeah, I think this is a very important thing that could really help out the audit committees in doing their job.
Yeah, we appreciate those comments.
Yeah, and the communications with audit committees, Lynn, was not on the list last year, and I don't have a copy of Tom's remarks from last year, and his comments are on our website, and pretty certain he addressed it. We did get some consideration and you know, at a staff level, and it was not included on a priorities list, but certainly we have these discussions for a reason every year to get feedback, and there's been a number of members talking about communications with audit committees, so we will certainly give that consideration. Barbara Roper.
Following on to what Lynn was just saying, part of what, when we talk about this and we keep talking about priorities and whatnot, I get the sense, given how many projects do seem to sort of drop off the list or take a protracted period of time, that we may be dealing with overly constrained resources that are being brought to bear on this task, and that there really needs, as you say, the budget is a work in progress, there really needs to be serious consideration given to whether this activity of the board is being adequately funded. And if areas are priorities and if they have been identified as important, some sort of formal assessment about what kind of funding level it would take to get them done, not just in the standard setting area, but in other aspects of the board's activities as well, you know, ought to be part of that project, that process, and I hope it is. And I would hope that there would be some sort of transparency around those considerations. The other thing I wanted to talk about is a number of people have talked about the importance of convergence. And, you know, while I certainly think it is important that the board be cognizant of what other standard setters are doing and use that process to identify what they are doing well, I think that's a process that can be taken to extremes, and I would caution against that, in the sense that I think once you make convergence an end in itself, it can be difficult to justify doing things differently, even when you think doing things differently would result in doing them better. And so while I think there is certainly a value to paying attention, close attention to what others are doing, finding out what works well, I don't think it should be made an end in itself by this board.
Thank you, Barbara. Are there any other comments regarding our standard setting accomplishments and priorities? I don't see any tent cards, but I'll just pause in case anyone has any final views or thoughts. Yes, Mark.
Let me make just a couple of observations. And first of all, I don't know that I've said it recently, but I doubt that the members of this group fully appreciate the extent to which we appreciate and take into consideration the input from the SAG. It is critically important to our thinking. I doubt that a day goes by where, in terms of how we are utilizing the board time and how we are determining priorities, that the input from the SAG isn't part of those decisions. So I would just like to say thank you for your consideration and thank you for the time you put in. I recognize that pro bono time means that you're here in place of doing something else, and for us to ask busy people and fully engaged people to spend their time here, we fully appreciate. Let me talk a little bit, just quickly. We have a very, I think an effective strategic planning process. The role of standard setting takes an important component of our strategic planning time, and the issues that you've raised today are all issues that we're spending a lot of time with, including the manner in which we work with other standard setters and the capacity outside of the PCA to be involved in that process. I think those are very valid comments. We have included them in our discussions and will continue to include them in our discussions. I've said that publicly before, and I want to repeat it now that I think that that is very important. The transparency of the process is something that we also want to take into consideration, and your thoughts here are very valuable. And our budget process essentially flows from the strategic planning process, as it should, in any organization. And obviously we have to make choices. We feel we are fully accountable on that budget. The SEC, I know Paul, feels that we're fully accountable in that process. Paul is our point person in that effort, and I think he can probably speak to that issue. And so I just wanted to say to Barbara and others that those are issues that we do take into consideration, and your input here I think is very valuable to us. And I have a plane to catch, so if this goes long, I may have to leave early. But
we're ending on time. That seems like an appropriate wrap-up for that section, so then just like to make some final remarks and close the session. Thank you so much for your input and feedback during this meeting. As Mark just said, your feedback is extremely important to us, and so I appreciate your efforts. I think this is a very good meeting, had a lot of great discussion, and we will go back and consider it in determining our future direction. This is the last scheduled meeting of 2008. As we get closer to when the 2009 meeting will be, we will announce that, but we haven't announced that or finalized on that yet. About half of the members' terms are expiring this year, and some of them are seeking reappointment. Not all of them are. We have not announced who those members will be, but we plan to do that shortly. But for those members whose terms are expiring this year, and may or may not be back on for various reasons, I just want to extend gratitude for your contributions. And so thank you very much. Thank you again for your time during this meeting. Greatly appreciate it. And that concludes this session. So safe travels home. Thank you.